At first, there was only silence. And if I opened my eyes, there was darkness. I could remember nothing clearly. I did recall the doctor's arrival at the door, then Milne's appearance, and being forced back into the house. But after that, my memory was a blank. I had no idea where I was, or how I had come to be there. As my head cleared, so I became gradually more aware of my surroundings. I could hear sounds, ugly sounds that I wanted to shut out again the moment I heard them. Things slithering, things bumping, things sucking. Although it was pitch black, I guessed now where I had been taken. I was back in that abominable old church. "Andrew, how are you feeling now?" It was McLean, his voice solicitous. I opened my eyes and blinked hard. He was standing next to me, holding a lantern of some kind. "I'm sorry if you have been uncomfortable, Andrew, but you must understand that it is for the best. Angus is upstairs, or Duncan, if you prefer. He'll be ready to start as soon as preparations are completed. You mustn't worry. He doesn't intend to let anything unpleasant happen to you. Quite the contrary. If you cooperate, you'll find him most appreciative. He'll take you through the ritual until you've got it right." To my surprise, I found that I could speak. "What if I don't do what he wants?" "That would be extremely foolhardy. Don't even think of it. If you make him happy, your father will experience full recovery. Otherwise, his condition will deteriorate. Katrina is not his wife." "But he wants her. He deserves to have her. She won't want him." "You are really being very naive. If he can bring her back from the dead, don't you think he can influence her affections at the same time? And why does he need me? Why can't he do it himself? Without your presence and your participation, the whole thing may go wrong again." He hesitated. "I'll leave you now," he said, "for a little while, to think things over." I cannot be sure how much time passed before I saw an old man come shuffling towards me, supported by McLean. The doctor held a lantern as before, and the other man a candle in a holder. It was impossible to tell how old he was. His face and body were skeletal. He wore a long black gown of pure silk and leaned on a tall staff. Scraps of white hair clung to an otherwise naked skull.
"I have missed you, Andrew," he said.
Milne's voice was thin, barely recognizable.
"I could have made something of you, but you let yourself be distracted by sentiment. I promised you the mastery you sought, and you still betrayed me. It is a tremendous disappointment."
He paused. While he had been speaking, I had seen that more than youth had been stripped away. All the politeness, all the bonhomie had gone too. In their place, I saw nothing but an iron will, the single-minded determination of a man who seeks only his own ends.
"You have had time to think about what is waiting, if you are uncooperative. But before we go upstairs, there is something else I want you to see."
McLean took my arm and urged me forward. We went through a low arch, then another, and came up against a wooden door which opened onto pitch darkness. McLean stood beside me and shone his light inside. Gradually I made out the hard shapes of coffins, a brightness of bones, and then crawling white forms and the sound of sucking and nibbling. I remembered the woodcut in the book, and I thought of the words at the end of Ian's letter. "Destroy everything. They are swarming. Angus brought them back from Morocco." I closed my eyes. Milne's voice came out of the darkness behind me, liquid and emotionless.
"The Carthaginians called them Ibat Tanit, the servants of Tanit. The Arabs simply called them Didan, maggots. They were found in an underground chamber in Tangier.
McLean withdrew the lamp.
It's time to finish what we came here for, said Milne.
McLean closed the door and locked it. Milne took my arm and guided me to a flight of narrow stairs. We came out into the main body of the church. As before, the only light came from candles set on tall sconces in the aisles. Where the altar had once stood, a trestle held a coffin. The last time I had seen the coffin had been in the cemetery in Glasgow when they lowered Katrina to what I had thought would be her final resting place. The lid had been prized off and replaced loosely on top. And so my last instruction began. Milne sat down with me and rehearsed me in what I should say or do. There were to be two rituals, and I understood why he was there that night as an old man. The time had come for another transformation, and for that he needed me. Not my body, but the life in it. He would suck me dry, like someone sucking juice from a pomegranate, and discard the husk. Duncan Milne would move from Edinburgh, and after a discreet interval, his son would appear in London, or Paris, or wherever took his fancy, a young man of intelligence and promise, with a young and beautiful wife. It was well into the morning before he was satisfied. My wording was perfect, my gestures accurate. All that remained was to bring them together, beginning with the ritual, to bring Katrina back among the living. We stood in front of the coffin.
Now, Andrew, it is time to begin.
I started to speak, reciting the words of the ritual almost by heart, glancing down from time to time at the open pages of the book. After a time, I became aware of a soft, irregular noise. As I reached the end of the incantation, there was a silence in which I listened carefully. A dull banging was coming from inside Katrina's coffin. I continued, though my hands shook and my voice trembled. To my horror, the banging slowed and was replaced by a long, piercing cry that changed in moments to whimpering. It was not the crying of a woman, I realized, but the frightened cry of a small baby, and it too was coming from within the coffin. Suddenly the candles around the coffin flickered. Something had disturbed the air. Milne had turned and was staring back down the nave. And then I heard a man's voice calling my name.
Andrew, leave them and come to me.
I turned and looked into the shadows at the back of the church. Two figures stood in front of the door.
It's all right, Andrew. Do as he says.
A woman's voice. The figures walked down the aisle, and I saw that they were Harriet and Father Silvestri. Milne pulled himself to his full height and pointed a finger at Silvestri.
Get out of here, priest! There's nothing you can do!
Silvestri ignored him. He continued walking towards the chancel, speaking to me in a calm, quiet voice.
He has no further hold over you, Andrew. Just step away from him. Go with Harriet. She knows what to do.
I started to step back, but at that moment the baby cried again. I could not leave it.
Stay where you are, Andrew. Milne's voice was cold and peremptory. Ramsay, hold him fast.
McLean made to take my arm, but I was awake now and full of anger. I hit him, full in the stomach, and as he doubled over, punched him hard in the throat. He fell back, choking and gasping for breath. I stumbled forward to the coffin and pushed aside the lid. I did not want to look inside, yet I had to find the baby. It was lying against Katrina's breast. I picked it up and clutched it to me, then staggered backwards. At that moment, I felt another arm take mine. Just as I was about to tear myself away, a voice whispered in my ear. A very gentle and familiar voice.
Come with me, love. It's time for you to leave.
And I knew beyond all doubt that this was no simulacrum, that Katrina herself had found me. she guided me through the confusion of the chancel, past flapping, shuffling shapes I dare not pause to examine, to where Silvestri and Harriet were waiting. I felt a kiss against my cheek. Then she was gone. Harriet reached forward and took the baby from me. I stammered, "Katrina?" Harriet nodded. "Yes, I saw her. But you have to let her go." The baby whimpered. Behind me I heard Milne's voice lifting in a conjuration. The candles flickered and went out. Harriet pulled me to the door. "What about Silvestri?" I asked. "It's what he wants," said Harriet. "He knows what he's doing." I turned at the open door. A bright, unnatural light was shining in the chancel. Angus Milne stood against it, outlined, his arms held high above his head. I could hear his voice ringing through the empty building. A second figure, no more than a shadow, moved towards him as though fighting against a high wind. The door closed, and we were outside in the freezing cold. A young priest was waiting for us at the rectory. Silvestri had given him careful instructions on what to do with us. "You must leave Edinburgh tonight," he said. "Both of you. I have some money you can take. You must never come back here, and no one must know where you have gone. You'll have to change your names, take on new identities. I will be able to help you. Leave the baby here tonight. I'll see it's taken care of and return to its parents in the morning." "Andrew," he said, "I do not think you will ever know peace again until you die. That creature in Fez has long tentacles. Milne is not easily tired, and he has a long memory. Wherever you go, you will have to be on the watch all the time. Trust no one, confide in no one, befriend no one, and above all, let no one befriend you." We left soon afterwards, driving north in Harriet's car. We drove on through the night into greater and greater darkness. And on my cheek, I could still feel the touch of lips that had not been there. The sea inhabits our darkness and our light. Its rising and falling is a token that all is well, day by day. We live in a little house near an inlet on a small island that I shall not name. Harriet weaves. I am learning the art of dry stone walling, and I'm a passable mason. It helps that I speak Gaelic. People do not ask too many questions. Harriet and I were married soon after we arrived here. It seemed best. And we find we love one another well. Harriet expects a child next spring. I heard something outside the house last night. Perhaps it was just my imagination. I said nothing to Harriet. But if it returns tonight, I shall have to tell her. It will be time for us to move again. For us, it has become as the words of the psalm. They wandered in the wilderness, in a solitary way. They found no city to dwell in.
That was the concluding part of The Matrix by Jonathan Aycliffe, read by Robert Patterson. The producer was David Jackson Young.